Good evening. My name is Phil Cadillo. I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the newcomers, the out-of-towners. Happy birthday to Zach and Dave. Sean from New York. I want to apologize up front if I suck. It's Larry's fault. He's been badgering me for quite some time to do this. A lot of you people that have been around this meeting for a while know my first sponsor was Larry Dixon. His sobriety date was 112288. He was very instrumental in getting this meeting started. He's a man that I dearly miss. My sobriety date is January 1st, 1996. My home group is Claremont Men's, and my sponsor is Dave T. I've got a lot of home group members that came that made the trek all the way out here tonight to support me. I've got guys that I sponsor, and I'm very happy to be here. Please give another hand for Barbara. That was fantastic. Thank you. She put it in 10 minutes. There's no even really reason for me to speak tonight, but I will try to tell my story the best possible. I am grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. I started drinking pretty early, around 11 or 12. I think it was 12. The first time I got drunk was my neighbors had older neighbors that were next door, and they said, "Hey, you want to go to a party?" And I'm like, "Yeah, sure, let's go." And so I went to this party, and there was a bunch of people in a room, and they were kind of in this circle, you know. And there was, if I remember right, there was a bottle of Mad Dog 2020. There was a bottle of Boone's Farm. There was a bottle of Schlitz. There was all these different bottles going around, and monkey see, monkey do. Everybody's taking a sip, so I'm taking a sip, and man, I got hammered, and I got drunk, and we went out and did some stuff I don't quite remember. And next thing you know, I'm getting sick, and I'm hearing my neighbors yelling at me, "Don't get sick in my truck! Don't get sick in my truck!" And he's taking me into the house, and I, in between hurling, I hear my parents laughing, you know, and at that time I had a paper route with 150 customers, and the next morning was Sunday morning, and Sunday morning papers were pretty big at that time, and I had quite a few customers that liked their paper early. And you know, let me back up a little bit, though. You know, early on in my life, as far back as I can remember, there was always something different about me versus my brothers and my sister, my brother and my sister. There always just seemed to be this underlying difference, you know. They were dark-haired, and I was blonde-haired, and, you know, the dad that, my first stepdad that I thought was my father, Frank Sr., he didn't necessarily treat me different, but there was just something going on there. He was in the Navy. We lived in Navy housing in Linda Vista, my early recollections were that the next thing I know, they were split up, and my mom was going out with this new guy, and he was mean, so I had this Disneyland dad that lived in Poway, who I thought was my real father, but was not. So I would go to his house on the weekends, and I would crack beers for him and steal a sip on the way around the corner and keep his beer full, you know. And he would take us out to the Colorado River. We had a boat, and I could run around till 10 o'clock at night when I was 6 years old. It was heaven, you know. And my brother and sister were running amok. And then in 1971, my little brother was born. And my mom got remarried to my father that is now. Got remarried, and my little brother was born in 1971. And we lived in Linda Vista at the time, and we moved to Kearney Mesa. And right around that time, my brother, I don't remember quite how old my brother was, my brother and sister seemed to be getting in a lot of trouble with the stepdad. A lot of trouble, you know, and it was... And at that time, punishment was delivered in a different way. Just put it that way. You know, it was 2x4 justice. It was not timeout justice, if you know what I mean. And so there was a lot of yelling. There was a lot of screaming. There was a lot of physical violence. And it was just this. I just remember as being this just out of control, just whack thing, you know, and waiting for him to get home to hand out the punishments. And I got my fair share. So one night I hear my brother's sneaking out the window, you know. I wake up in the morning and my brother's not in his room. My brother had ran away. He had run away. He had grabbed a couple of cans of soup. He had grabbed a can opener and made his way through Miramar Navy Base, stopped along the way, had a couple of sternos, heated up a can of soup, had some soup, and ran away to my stepdad's house, Frank Sr.'s house. Shortly after that, my sister went. And the reason I talk about this is because it was one of the early impacts in my life where, okay, I want to go too. Frank went, Pam went, what about Philip? You know, Philip's left here with the mean dude. What's, you know, what the hell is that? I'm like, this ain't right. Something's wrong here. And I didn't quite understand, you know, I didn't understand. And shortly after that, they moved out to Yuma, Arizona. They moved out to the river. Frank Sr. had retired from the Navy. My brother and sister went with him. The last recollection I had of my brother here in town was he played football for Mount Carmel High School. And he was good at football. He was just this big, mean, ugly football machine, you know, and he was a tight end, man, and I went up to watch him, man, and he caught 3 touchdown passes that night at Mount Carmel High School, and I think they were playing against Poway, and he caught 3 touchdown passes, man, and he left the field with 2 women on his arms, you know, and I went, man, that's the guy I want to be, you know, that is the guy, and he had a 61 Chevy that Frank Sr. had bought him, he was driving, man, I was like, dude, he had arrived, you know what I mean, that's the way, that was my perception, was that he was there. And life was good. And shortly after that, they moved out to the river up north of Yuma. And I didn't see much of them after that, you know. So here I am, 12 years old. I'm hungover like crazy. I got 150 papers to put together. I had to put the middle section together. It's about 6:30 in the morning. I'm laying on the porch. And I'm sitting up, and I'm putting 2 or 3 papers together, and I'm laying back down on the porch, and every once in a while in the planter box, I was feeding the planter box, man, and it was brutal. I got through that. A buddy of mine came by with a moped. He had a moped. He had another paper route somewhere else and helped me out that morning. And I came home, and I went back to bed, you know. I went back to bed, and I said, man, that was brutal. I don't think I want to do that again. And next Friday night, they said, hey, you want to go to a party? And I said, yeah. And that's kind of the way it went. I was driving my neighbor's cars, about 14. I when they were building 805, I was telling somebody this story. We were talking about when they built 805. And I know this goes beyond, there's a lot of young people here, but there's a lot of gray here, man. And there's a few people that remember that. We got in a little trouble we found the keys to the tractor. That they were one of the tractors, and I got a ride home in a cop car that day, you know. And I wasn't so much worried about the cop as I was worried about the mean guy at home, you know. I got dealt a little justice that day, and it cost me 3 broken fingers. I don't mention that. I'm laying the foundation for something. I want you to be crystal clear on this. I don't blame my alcoholism on my parents. I don't blame my alcoholism on my brothers. I blame my alcoholism on me, okay? Those relationships have all been repaired and all being forgiven through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps. I'm about 14 and I'm drinking and I'm smoking pot and I'm doing cocaine and I'm running amok and I'm delivering those papers still. You know, and when I was about 15, one of my customers would always give me an extra $10 every month. And the paper was only $7.50 a month or something like that at that time. He'd give me an extra $10 a month if I had that paper in his truck by 5:30 in the morning. So I was collecting for the paper one day, and I said, hey, do you have any work? I knew he was in construction. I had no clue of what he did. And he says, you want a job, boy? And I said, yes, sir, I do. He says, be here at 5:30 tomorrow and have my goddamn paper. And I said, I said, okay. So I went to work that day with a man named Dale Keith, and we hung about 1,600 sheets of drywall with a big crew, and he peeled off 200, he peeled off 10 20s, $200, and put it in my hand, and he says, you want to work tomorrow? And I had bloody fingers, and my head hurt from holding that drywall up, and I said, yes, sir, I do. And So I went to work the next day for him. And he says, you know how to drive? And I said, yes, I do. And he says, do you have a car? And I said, no, I don't. And he said, good, you can go get lunch in my truck. And so I worked for him. I worked for Dale Keith on and off for about the next 3 or 4 years during the summers and all that. I've always been a worker. You know, I started out pulling weeds at the gas station there at Kearney Mesa, and then it was a pretty big day when they gave me a key to the cash box. It's back when they actually had people at the gas station that took the money, that were outside, not in a little booth. So I've always worked, man. I worked at the gas station. I had that paper route, and then I was working for Dale. And I'm playing football and baseball, and I'm trying to keep. I'm trying to maintain, you know, but it's very apparent at a very early age that I drank and smoked and snorted more than all my friends, and longer. You know, when they said I got to go home and do some homework, I said, "There's still beer left. What's the matter with you? You know, let's get this done." And so, right around that time, I got a job at this place called Square Pan Pizza, on the corner. On the corner of Linda Vista Road and Mesa College Drive, and I went to work at Square Pan Pizza for a while, and that was an adventure, and it was and they had cold beer on tap, and we drank plenty of that cold beer every night after closing, you know, shortly after that I got this job at a liquor store, and that's when things really started going downhill. I worked at H&M Home Bar Liquor in Kearney Mesa at the age of 16 or 17. I'm trying to hold it together. School was always very easy for me. I was always A's and B's without trying. I was always in advanced classes. It really wasn't an issue. I didn't have to do a whole lot of studying. And I'm not bragging. I'm just saying that wasn't the deal, you know. I used to sell answers to the smart guy, the guys who were trying to be smart, and just made that hustle that way. So I started working at this liquor store, you know, and that's when my drinking became daily. It became daily, usually it was a case a night out the back door out of that place. And I was drinking the whole time I was in there. And occasionally when you overshoot the mark a little bit, you forget to get rid of the empty cans. And the next day the owner comes in and asks you what's going on. That's not mine. Learned how to lie at a pretty early age to avoid the mean guy at home. Sometimes that lying got me in trouble. Sometimes it saved me from trouble. So I'm working in this liquor store, and I'm getting to know everybody in the neighborhood, and I pretty much knew everybody in the neighborhood already, but I'm starting to get to know everybody in the neighborhood, you know. There was quite a bit of stuff going on in Kearney Mesa at the time, so I would usually end up at somebody's house after that, and I would usually end up there till 2 or 3 in the morning doing various outside issues. I was drinking and doing drugs alcoholically at 17 every night. So I'm still trying to maintain football and baseball, and I was pretty decent at football, and I had a few colleges that were interested in me, and 11th grade came around, and that was a long summer between 10th and 11th grade, and then it was even a longer summer between 11th and 12th grade. So 12th grade, I just decided not, you know, screw it. You know, screw it. I don't need to play football or baseball. It's not worth it. You know, it's not worth my time. It's too much time. I'd rather be out drinking and chasing girls. And that's what I did. So I made it through high school. I might have to get rid of this jacket because I'm sweating like a pig up here. I make it through. I'm glad that was a girl that said, take it off. I didn't wear a tie tonight because it's too hot. I'm sorry. But I did wear a suit and a nice shirt. I had a respect for the meeting. I had a respect for my dead sponsor, Larry Dixon. So I'm doing a lot of... outside issues. And when you do a lot of outside issues, it becomes very clear that you need to sell outside issues to be able to do a lot of outside issues. So I had this little 72 Chevy Love truck that I bought for $800 with my own money. The mean guy didn't help me do anything on that one. And I bought that truck, and it had no dash. The dash was eaten out, right? And it was eaten out, so it was more convenient to lay a towel on there. And so I had this towel on there, and underneath that towel was usually a 1/16 of dope and a quarter ounce of pot and everything else that you needed. And I also had a little compartment that I cut a hole in the floor, and I made a little cooler, and I was a mechanic as a trade, so I started tearing apart my bicycle when I was about 6, and putting it back together, and I built my first small block engine at 16, and I've just been a gearhead ever since. And so I tear this thing apart, and I put this little secret compartment in there, and I put some styrofoam in there, and it could hold a case of beer. It was pretty convenient, and keep it cold with a little bit of ice. So I'm running around, and I'm doing all this stuff, you know, and it starts getting very noisy up here. It starts getting very noisy up here, and I didn't want to live with my parents anymore. I didn't want to, you know, this whole time my little brother was the golden child, could do no wrong, and everything I did was wrong, and it really played on my head for a while. And so when I turned, when I got out of high school, I took off for Phoenix, Arizona. I went to Phoenix, Arizona to become a mechanic, take auto and diesel mechanics at a place called the Universal Technical Institute, and so that's what I did. And I was hoping that I would slow down a little bit on the partying when I got out there, but it wasn't the case. It certainly wasn't the case. You turn a resourceful guy loose in Phoenix, Arizona, and you're going to make things happen. So we had the party apartment. Just give you a little picture of that. One night, 3:30 in the morning. That day, we were supposed to go out and buy an engine for my roommate's car and pay rent. We came back with a 7-piece Kenwood stereo set up, a keg of beer, and a quarter pound of weed. And 3:30 in the morning, the manager's driving by, and we've got 2 2x4s going across, and we're lifting the engine out of this car, and because we were going to replace the engine that night. We wanted to get it running by dawn. And we got a little bit of trouble that night. But so I went over to Phoenix, Arizona, and I started doing a lot of deep, dark things that I said I was an athlete, and I swore I would never do that stuff. And I started putting needles in my arm, and I found myself in these deep, dark places, and I'm drinking the whole time, and I'm going to school 6 hours a day, and I'm working 8 hours a day. And every night on the way home, I would go, I'm going home, and I'm going to bed. I'm going home, and I'm going to bed. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, underneath the streetlight, playing hacky sack with a beer in my hand, I'm going, what happened? What happened? I was going to go to bed. And it just didn't happen. And so this went on and on and on. And at this time, about this time, I'm 18, and I'm used to going about 72 hours without any sleep. It's just commonplace, you know. And I'm drinking the whole time. And I'm working at this gas station, and I'm stealing out of the till so I could get a couple of beers on the way home, you know. And I'm taking money from this man out of this man's cash register when cash deals. And no receipt, no proof. What was supposed to be an 11-month school program ended up taking me a year and a half. I stole my first car over there. I got in a lot of trouble. I finally graduated that class, and my mom and my girlfriend, my high school sweetheart, came out, and we're heading for the state line. And I've got quite a few warrants out for my arrest, and a highway patrolman pulls in behind me around Welton, Arizona, which is the other side of Yuma, and I'm getting nervous. I'm getting nervous. I'm like, they're gonna throw me in jail. He's gonna pull me over. He's gonna throw me in jail. My mom's gonna start crying. The girlfriend's gonna start crying, and I just wasn't looking forward to that. And that didn't happen. I made it across the state line, came back to San Diego, and I didn't go back to Arizona for about 10 years. This is about 5 years ago. 5 years ago, they wouldn't renew my license. They said, you got to come down to DMV. And I said, okay. So I go down to DMV. And when I go down to DMV, I stand in line. I'm taking, you know, take time off of work, go down to stand in line. And I get up to the window, and I said, you know, I sent in the money. I said, they're not renewing my license. And the lady says, well, young man, it seems that the state of Arizona has a hold on your license. And I just, oh, Jesus. And so I said, well, how much is this going to cost me? And she says, well, here's a phone number. You need to go and call them, you know. So I proceeded immediately home and called the state of Arizona DMV. And the lady looks and she goes, "Wow, these were from a long time ago." And I go, "Yeah, 1984. I go, 85. And she goes, "Well, let me see. What are we going to do about this?" And I said, "Ma'am, just tell me what I need to do to make it right." And she says, "Well, since they're so old, how about a $24 processing fee?" I said, "Would you like Visa or MasterCard?" I said, "I'll FedEx cash if you want. Let's get this thing done." And so took care of that. So I come back to San Diego. I'm 19. I'm a full-blown alcoholic. I'm drinking every day. I'm doing about a 16th of Crystal a day. And I'm just this train wreck of a human being. I was about 160 pounds. And during one of these little parties, I came home and I was living at home, and my parents were gone for the weekend, and my girlfriend says, "Hey, I need to talk to you." And I said, "Yeah, what's up?" And I just got done doing some outside issues, and I had a nice cold beer in my hand. She says, "I'm pregnant." And I said, what I left out of the story is that while I was in Phoenix, Arizona, she had called me and she was pregnant. And after a visit out there, and she said, "I need you to be home on this date and go with me to get it taken care of." And I'm an alcoholic, man. You put things off and you put things off and you procrastinate, and I didn't make it, you know. So when she told me this time, I said, "Okay, let's get married." And there's something deep down inside me that knew a long time ago in 11th grade when I met this woman that that she was the one and I was screwed, and so I might as well get married anyway. And I said, "Let's get married." She said, "You do that?" And I said, "Yeah." So we went to Las Vegas and got married in August of 85. In December of 85, my son was born. And I was half in the bag when my son was born at Kaiser Hospital right down here on Zion. He was born 9 pounds, 1 half ounce, and my wife was 105 pounds when she got pregnant, and it was a large baby, you know, and that moment rocked my world for a short period of time. My life got really different, you know, and then I just started drinking again and drinking again and drinking again, and I couldn't hold a job. I had this job at the Navy Exchange, and I got the job at the Navy Exchange so I could get some good insurance, and I got fired from that job, and I was, I get a little emotional when I start talking about this part of my story, because there's still times where I'm not real, real proud of it, you know, and there was times where I'd disappear for 2 or 3 days at a time, and I ended up at strange places, and with strange people, and trying to figure out how I got there, and trying to figure out who had a cigarette that I could bum, and so when you don't show up to work, they don't like that too much, and I lost a couple of jobs, and so I finally found this job. During that time, we had purchased a house in Linda Vista. We scraped together a few bucks. My parents kicked in a couple bucks, and we bought this house. And my son was walking around, you know, he's running around, and I'm just stoked, you know, but I can't stop drinking. I just can't stop drinking. So when I lost this job, I started contemplating suicide at that time. I started contemplating suicide because I had no hope. I was drinking every chance I had. I was drinking, doing everything, man, and I just had no hope. I couldn't stop. I was beginning to come to that realization that on my own power, I could not stop. I had no clue about Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no clue about you people. I had no clue about anything. During this time period, I had, you know, there was one time where I told my wife, you know, in between these times, I was getting kicked out of the house on a regular basis, and I was sleeping on lawn furniture, and I was just really an upstanding guy. But so during this time, I had told my wife, I said, I can't stop. And she says, "Yeah, I know." And I said, "No, I'm asking you for help. I need help." So we went to this doctor. And I looked at this doctor, and I said, "I can't stop drinking and using, and I need help." And unfortunately, this doctor at that time, obviously wasn't very educated on alcoholism or drug addiction, and he said, I can put you on a list and we can get you in somewhere in 3 or 4 months. And right then and there, my whole world just dropped out. My everything just fell on the floor. I mean, I looked at the guy and I said, look, you don't understand. In 3 or 4 hours, this thing's going to tell me, come on, cowboy, it wasn't that bad. Let's go give it another ride, you know? And so at that point, I really had no hope. And so I'm just this mess. And I'm getting fired from jobs. And my poor wife is holding things together. She's holding things together somehow, some way. And I can't stop. And I would end up walking places, you know. I would end up walking places because I had sold my car. So I would be walking places when the sun was coming up, you know. And I just remember that feeling, man. I hope I never forget that feeling of just being utterly hopeless in life, you know. And there was times where I stuck a gun in my mouth on a regular basis in the garage at 3 or 4 in the morning. And I just didn't want my son to find me. And that's the only reason I didn't blow my brains out in that garage. So I get this job at a dealership, at this Chrysler Jeep dealership. And this guy says, you want to work for me? And I said, yeah, I want to work for you. And I told you guys I was a mechanic, so, and a pretty weak one at that time. And he says, all right. He says, you're going to work right there. You're going to work on anything that I tell you, and you're going to do it for $7 an hour. And I was so desperate, I said, I'll do it. And so I went to work for this man, you know, and I started making some money. And when I started making some money, I started partying harder. And I was partying the whole time. And I would go MIA. And then this man said, his name was Steve Wilson. He passed away about 6 months ago. Bless his heart. He always took credit for my sobriety after I got sober. He would come to my house in the morning, and he'd pick me up. And he'd take me to work, and then he'd bring me home at night, and he wouldn't give me my check. I remember the first time I said, hey, you got paychecks, and he says, yeah, but I'm not giving you yours. And I said, why are you not giving me my paycheck? And he says, I'm going to give it to your wife so she can pay the mortgage, because you take your check and you never show up for 4 days. And I said, okay. So, you know, I had no defense on that one, man. I'm like, guilty. So he fired me several times before he really fired me. And he said, I got to let you go. And I said, again? And he said, I'm not kidding this time. And I said, what's the deal, Steve? And he says, I can't watch you kill yourself any longer. He says, I watched my best friend kill himself when we were 24. I can't watch you kill yourself any longer. And I said, man, I'll come in and I'll mop the stalls. I'll clean the bathrooms. I'll do whatever I got to do. And he says, no, Phil, it's over. He says, I can't watch it anymore. So I left that place and I went to work at this Balboa Dodge. I got this job at Balboa Dodge at the time over on Balboa Avenue. And while I was there, I was still drinking and I was still using, but it was different. It was different, man. I was done. I couldn't stop. I didn't know what to do, man. I didn't know where to go. I didn't know. So I'm sitting in the garage one afternoon and my best friend Jack comes over. I have a beer and he says, hey, he says, if I set it up, will you go to rehab? And I said, yes. And I tried to grab that yes back before it got to his ears. And he says, all right, we're going tomorrow. He goes, tomorrow night we're going, you know, we're going to go out to API and we're going to check it out. And what had happened was that one of his friends at work, drank himself to death. And his buddy told him, Jack, if there's anybody in your life that's out of control, you need to get him help, and you need to get help now before they're gone. And so Jack decided to help me. So he set it up. And so 2 nights later, I went into API up here in La Mesa. And so Mom and Dad helped. Mom and the mean guy helped with that. And the wife had managed to put a little bit of money away. And so when I went into API, they gave me these little pills and said, here's your room. And so I took those pills and I went to sleep, and when I woke up they brought me food and I could eat and I could go outside and have a smoke, and I'd come back in and go back to bed, and they gave me another blue pill, and all was well for a couple of days because I hadn't slept for 96 hours before I went into that rehab. And I was 152 pounds dripping wet. I had open sores all over my face, and I was bleeding from bunch of different places in my body. It was not good, you know, and I just wanted to die, and I didn't have any hope. So after a couple of days of that, it was a pretty sweet deal, actually. They bring me food, eat, go out and have a smoke, go back to bed, take a little happy pill. So after a couple of days of that, they said, okay, now you need to go to a room down here, and you need to go to the meeting downstairs. And I'm like, the meeting? And they're like, yeah, you need to go downstairs. And I'm like, okay, so I went downstairs. And I believe that was the battery chargers at the time. And I went down to the battery chargers, and I went to this meeting, and I looked, and there was this guy that was the secretary at the time. His name was Rick. He was an ex-pro football player. He was 6'5", 590 pounds or something like that. He was just this huge behemoth of a man, and I'm like, well, I'm not going to mess with that guy. But there was all these people, and they were happy, and when we introduced ourselves as newcomers from API, they all clapped, you know, and I was like, wow, this is a trip. And I'm like, what is this deal? I turned to the guy, I'm like, what is this deal? And they're like, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. And those are the first times I'd ever heard those words. That was the first time I'd ever heard those words. I'd never had a clue about AA before that. And so I went through that rehab. And I went through that rehab. I did 10 days in there because I insurance wouldn't cover it, what have you. So I kept hearing this get a sponsor thing, you know, get a sponsor. So I saw this guy, Larry Dixon. And Larry had some game. If you were lucky enough to know Larry, Larry had some game, you know. And I said, this guy looks like he knows what's going on. He looks like he's a man that can get some things and get some things done. And I said, hey, would you help me find a sponsor? And this was a battle that we had for 20 plus years. I think I said, can you help me find a sponsor? What Larry heard was, will you be my sponsor? And so he says, you're going to follow me. Okay. He goes, you're going to follow me around. We're going to go to meetings. We're going to go and answer phones. We're going to go and sweep up cigarette butts. We're going to do anything that we got to do, fill you in. And I'm like, what do I have to lose, you know? At that time, I was just like, it was kind of this, rehab was a oasis in the desert of futility, if you will. For me, it got me out of the storm long enough to have my eyes open enough to be able to get to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I started following Larry around, and Larry was a busy man. He went to a meeting every night. We answered phones. We went down to San Diego State. We swept up dorm rooms. We did anything that we could for a couple of bucks. I was hurting for money at the time, and Larry was hurting for money at the time. And I followed that man around, and we started working the steps. And we cracked that book open at McDonald's, and we started reading that book. And we did step studies, and I worked the steps with Larry. And I remember that first time I wrote a four step, and I went to share it with him doing a fifth step. And I shared my fifth step with him, and he looked at me and he says, "Is there anything else?" And I said, "No, I don't think so." And he said, "Well, check this out, Phil. This is what happened with me. This is what I did." And when he shared some of that stuff with me, I had two gut reactions. You know, I need to tell him, or I need to get the hell out of here. And I told him, you know, and we sat there and I told him everything, man. I told him everything. And I got it out on the table, man. And he says, "I want you to go home and I want you to sit quiet for an hour or two. And then I want you to read the book and read, do this and do this and do this." And I followed his advice and I got sober. I got sober and I stayed sober for about, and my life got incredibly good. And I went back to work for that man that saved me, Steve Wilson. And I started making more money than I ever made in my life. And I started buying stuff. Okay, if you're in the hunt for stuff, good luck with that. All I can tell you is how it worked out for me. I got the motor homes, I got the motorcycles. I started racing dirt bikes. I started, doing buggies. I started doing the whole thing, man. But in the meantime, I got my son racing. My son started racing when he was four, and by the time he was seven, he had three or four bikes, and we were racing up and down the state of California, and he was sponsored, and we had a good time, man. But I stopped going to meetings about four years, stopped going to meetings, and I quit. And I quit working with my sponsor, and I quit sponsoring guys, and I got drunk. First time around, I knew I was a dope addict. And they said, "Phil, it's a good idea if you stop drinking." And I said, "Check that." You know, sounds like a good idea at the time, too. But I never fully concede to my innermost self that I was alcoholic, that I was bodily and mentally different from my fellows, that I have an allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind that makes me different from somebody else that's sitting at the bar. I did not realize that, okay? So when I went back out there, I went back out there for about 6 months, and my sponsor, Larry Dixon, came to my house on January 1st, 1996. And he said, Phil, you've had enough. It's time for you to come back. And I said, you know, you're right, Larry, because I didn't want to come back in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and look at you and raise my hand as a newcomer and tell you that I drank again. After everything that I'd done, secretarying meetings, doing this, doing that, H&I, you know, all the stuff that I had done to get and stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I quit doing it and I got drunk. And when I came back, I had this, I don't know what you call it, it was just this feeling of complete defeat. My great-grand sponsor calls it, the war's over and you lost, accept it. And that's the feeling that I had. So I got busy, and that was 18 years, 10 months, and 4 days ago. And for that, I'm eternally grateful. There's a couple of people in my life that passed away. One of them was Polly Grabone. He got killed on his Harley. Guy turned left in front of him. That impacted my life tremendously because he was part of my inner group. He was one of my soulmates that I shared everything with as well. We sat there and watched him pump blood into him at the hospital from 11 o'clock to 4 in the morning. And as good alcoholics, we stole the code to get into the ICU. And so we took turns holding his hand while they pumped blood into him, and he was already brain dead. And his wife came out and asked us. There was about 20 alcoholics that were in the hallway. It was part of our inner group. They came out in the hallway and she said, Marcy looked at me and Larry and she said, what do I do? And we said, Marcy, you got to let him go. You got to let him go. He's been dead since 7 o'clock. They just keep pumping blood into him and it's coming out of his eyes. And that rocked my world. That rocked my world. And that was alcohol. That was Alcoholics Anonymous, big time. And if you've never been through that, or if you're going through it for the first time, it has an impact on your life that you will never, ever, ever forget. The second impact on my life was when Larry Dixon died. He died of a sudden heart attack. And I remember getting the call. I was at work. And Larry meant more to me than just about anybody in my life except my wife and children. He came to my house and saved me. Saved me. He came to API, to meetings, and saved me. By carrying the message. By carrying the message, he saved me. I'm going to try to be brief here. I went too long, and there's some very important things that I left out. My daughter was born after I got... My wife got pregnant while I was in rehab in API. My daughter was born, and little boys are your pride and joy, but little girls will steal your heart. My daughter was a year and a half old. The babysitter beat the crap out of her. She laid up there in Children's Hospital in ICU. And I was engaged fully in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the only reason that I didn't kill that woman. I had offers from all my friends to take care of her, take her on a one-way trip out to the desert, and I didn't take up any of those offers. And my daughter pulled through that, and the San Diego police decided to try to prosecute me for doing it while I was at work. And it was an amazing journey. And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, La Mesa Men's, and my sponsor carried me through that, and God. I have an amazing life today. I have an amazing life today. I have that same position as that guy Steve Wilson in the dealership now. I have about 45 people underneath me. All this is possible through God and Alcoholics Anonymous and doing the steps and getting that spiritual awakening that give me. And the second step where I was able to write out a perception, my perception of God. You know, not somebody else's, not the church's, not anybody else, but my perception. I have a life beyond my wildest dreams. Beyond my wildest dreams. They pay me a lot of money for what I do. My boss tells me I do a good job. I have friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a home group that the members are just fantastic, that I'm just plugged into these guys, man, and it's just this spiritual connection that you can't buy. You can't buy this stuff, man. You can't, you know. And that wife of mine that hung in there and took care of things, you know, we celebrated 29 years of marriage in August 17th of this year. That daughter that just about died when she was a year and a half old, was a straight-A student. She was a four-year varsity player. She played two or three years of college, small college ball, softball. She got her bachelor's degree, and she's the youngest ICU nurse in St. Joseph's Hospital in Stockton, California. That bouncing baby boy, he is a federal officer for the Border Patrol down in southern Arizona, and he's married to a nice girl. And And all these things are possible through God and Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I've been dealing with, I'm looking at my buddy Patrick, man, and he traveled a similar path to what I'm traveling now. And I try to take care of my mother. My mother was diagnosed 2 years ago with stage four lung cancer, and they gave her 9 to 14 months to live. And I told her, "You're too ornery to die, Mom. Let's do this." And I've had so many members of Alcoholics Anonymous come up to me and tell me, "Man, if I had one more time to be with my mom, even have lunch with her or dinner or just talk to her," and they give me inspiration to keep on going when I go over there, and she's just going off about this little thing or that little thing, you know, and I just want to walk out and go, "Mom, that's enough," you know, because none of my brothers or sisters will take care of her. So I take care of her now, and I want to thank you. If you're new here, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. Man, this is the most amazing trip you will ever be on. They don't make drugs that do a trip like this, man. They don't. I was touched by your share. And I've got friends in here that are absolute miracles that I thought would never stop drinking. There's people around you, man, that if you just stop. Larry used to tell me this thing, man. He'd say, "Phil, I want you to put a quarter in your pocket." I said, "What's a quarter for, Larry?" And he says, "There's two things, Phil." And he says, "If you ever need to make a phone call, there's a quarter. You got a quarter in your pocket. And the other one is, I want you to rub that quarter." He says, "I want you to rub that quarter. When you get in times of stress, I want you to rub that quarter and pretend you're eating popcorn and watch the movie of life." He says, "Try not to participate and be one of the actors in that movie. Just watch the movie, you know." And in my movie, if I die tomorrow, man, my life is complete. I've done everything that I've ever wanted to do. I've been blessed beyond all get out, you know. And I want to thank Larry for asking me to share here tonight, and God bless.